The president and CEO of the Nature Conservancy is set to speak at Williams College tonight as part of the school's year-long focus on climate change. Mark Tursek graduated from Williams in 1979 and began a five-year term on the school's Board of Trustees in July. Tursek spent 24 years as a managing director and partner with the investment firm Goldman Sachs before joining the Nature Conservancy in 2008. Tursek spoke with WAMC about the ways the organization is combating climate change.
What I plan to emphasize in my remarks is the need for urgent action. There are lots of ways to approach climate change. There's philosophical issues, there's political issues to discuss, but what I want to focus on is the urgent need for humankind all around the world, and I'll probably focus a little bit more on the U.S. since that's where we are right now, on the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as fast as possible and as sizably as possible. The longer we wait, the harder it is, and the more permanent damage will be done. So that's what I'm going to want to focus on, actions. What can the Nature Conservancy do? What can Williams College do? And what can the audience do as individuals and also as members of different kinds of organizations?
And to that point, what are some of the things that the Nature Conservancy does to combat climate change?
Well, the Nature Conservancy, maybe some of your listeners don't know us. We are a conservation and environmental organization. Our mission is to save the lands and waters on which all life depends. And historically, we began 65 years ago in New York as a biodiversity-oriented organization. We grew fast because lots of people, first in the U.S. and then all around the world, liked our pragmatic, science-based focus on getting things done. We were the first land trust. We invented the conservation easement. We've been a champion of financial innovation to get conservation done at scale. So through most of our history, we've been focused on conservation. That's a little less contentious. Most people are for protecting land and water in order to benefit biodiversity and to benefit humans. But in the last couple of years, we've been saying to ourselves, gosh, if climate change is the biggest threat of them all, what can we do to attack that threat? So we're doing a few things. First, we're protecting and restoring ecosystems in order to sequester carbon. It turns out that forests or mangroves, grasslands, these ecosystems are carbon stores. So if we can restore them at scale, that can be a material tool in addressing climate. For example, the Paris Climate Accord of December, as much as a third of the greenhouse gas reductions it calls for could be achieved by protecting nature at scale. That's our historic sweet spot, so we are really focused on that. But we're also focused on another thing here in the U.S. The way we're organized in the U.S. is we have a chapter in every state, so we're kind of organized just like Capitol Hill. And each of our chapters is led by a group of volunteer leaders we call our trustees, and they're a very diverse group of people. They're Democrats and Republicans, they're old and young, they're rural and urban, they're professors, business people, ranchers, farmers, you name it. They're very, very diverse, but they have at least two things in common. They're passionate about nature, and they really believe in science. So we've asked all of our chapters and our volunteer constituents to really stick their neck out and fight for progress here in the U.S. on climate as fast as possible. In some places, that's relatively easy. For example, in a state like Massachusetts, where Williams is, it's a state that is very receptive to addressing climate change. In other states, so-called red states, or in some of the energy-producing states, or some of the manufacturing states that are very dependent on coal power, climate change is a tough issue to address because it's viewed as an obstacle for economic progress. But we're trying to make it safer to talk about climate change, and we're trying to be an advocate for and push for policy that will address climate change and the need to reduce emissions, but to do so on a basis that makes sense, that's consistent with economic growth, that's not divisive, that brings people together. That's the kind of thing we're trying to do.
Your book, Nature's Fortune, argues that business and society can thrive by investing in nature. How so?
Well, my book, Nature's Fortune, makes the argument that saving nature is probably the very best investment we face today. if you think of nature as natural capital, or for or maybe it's easier to understand as green infrastructure. So gray infrastructure is what we refer to as man-made infrastructure. Green infrastructure is nature providing services and benefits to humankind. For example, nature provides us the clean and healthy water we drink, the good food we eat, the stable climate we have and hopefully will preserve. Nature provides us protection from storms. Nature provides us the good topsoil in which we grow our food. Nature provides habitat for biodiversity. Nature does all of these things for us. And so what we're trying to get governments and business to understand is sometimes investing in green infrastructure is a better deal than gray infrastructure. It costs less, it outperforms, and you get a variety of environmental co-benefits for free. For example, in the coast area around Louisiana, et cetera, after Hurricane Sandy, there's widespread agreement that we need seawalls to provide protection from sea level rise and storms. Well, one option would be to build a man-made seawall. A seawall costs about $1 million a mile, and it does the job it's supposed to do. Alternatively, you can build and restore a oyster reef. Turns out an oyster reef to restore or build a new oyster reef for a mile also costs about $1 million. It performs just as well as providing protection from storms and sea level rise. Unlike man-made infrastructure, the green infrastructure of an oyster reef doesn't depreciate, but it actually appreciates over time. It grows in value. And of course, an oyster reef is not just a seawall. It's habitat for oysters, so the local communities get oysters. Oyster shells ultimately crumble. They nourish the beach. It's also habitat for other fish and birds. And so it's a win-win investment opportunity. Doesn't cost any more, it performs even better, and it gives you these other benefits for free. That's what we mean by investing in nature.
And Mark, there was a recent call by Williams College students, faculty, and alumni for the school to completely divest its endowment from top fossil fuel companies. The school decided not to go that route and instead announced a number of efforts and investments to combat climate change. As a Williams grad and also as a member of the college's board of trustees, I wanted to get your thoughts on the school's decision there.
Well, yes, I'm a Williams grad, and I'm a professional environmentalist. I'm now a Williams board member, but I am brand new. In fact, later this week will be my first board meeting, so I was not a board member as the board deliberated on this. So my comments are as an observer from the outside and as an alum. I was pleased by that whole process that you described. First, I was pleased to know that the Williams community, at least some members of it, cared enough about climate that they wanted to advocate for divestment. Divestment, I think, has been a good way to energize interest in and determined actions in connection with climate. It's a great attention raiser. It raises the issue on people's profile. Now, that group might be disappointed that Williams has not chosen to divest, at least as of yet, but that group should be pleased that Williams has chosen, at least in part in response to their initiative, to do three very important things. And I'm planning to talk about this in my remarks. First, the Williams administration and board said, we won't divest, but we will invest. The Williams Investment Committee has done an extraordinary job as stewards for the Williams Endowment. And they've told the worldwide investment community, bring us climate challenge addressing investment opportunities. We want to be a proactive investor in that area. I think over time, that's going to be a very material thing that Williams is doing. It's already generated a lot of attention. Second, Williams said, we're going to take our efforts on campus to reduce our own emissions even further. This is also a big deal. The best way to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which principally come from energy use, is to use less energy. It's the lowest cost way to reduce emissions, and it's renewable. We can do it forever. Williams is already, I think, performing pretty well here, and they're now promising to take it to the next level. That should provide good opportunities for others to learn from, and Williams students, as they graduate, they can bring that know-how with them wherever they go. And then the third thing Williams is doing is they said, we're going to set this academic year up, the one we're in right now, as a year in which we ask the entire community to engage on the topic of climate change. And let's face it, that's what Williams is. It's an academic community. And I think this is going to be a big deal. That indeed is the reason why I've been invited to speak tomorrow. And as an alum, I'm really proud. I think these three things that Williams are doing are material, and I think they're going to be a big deal. And I think the group you mentioned that campaigned for divestment, while they may be disappointed that they haven't succeeded on that front, they have helped to make some very important things happen on campus.
And finally, Mark, we talked about what the Nature Conservancy does and some of the organizations that it works with does on climate change efforts. For the average person in the audience, what can he or she do?
Well, the most important thing I ask individuals to do is to engage in politics. You know, politics right now in the U.S. and even around the world, this might not be its greatest shining moment of glory. Let's talk about the U.S. for a minute. I live in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of divisiveness on Capitol Hill right now. There's some dysfunction. It's discouraging. I get that. What some people seem to be seeing in the face of that is, I'm going to drop out. I'm going to disengage. I urge people not to do that. My impression of the elected officials we have in D.C. is they're good, well-intentioned people doing, again, what they think their voters want them to do. We need citizens, in my view, to be even more engaged in federal politics, in state politics, in local politics, because to make the progress we need, there's a lot organizations like the Nature Conservancy and Williams College can do on voluntary bases. But the most important thing is that we have robust regulatory policy and robust government investment programs that make sense and deliver the results we need. And the only way we're going to get them, and the only way we're going to overcome the divisiveness and partisanship that we face today, is for more citizens to be engaged. Sometimes when I say that, people roll their eyes and think I'm naive. But I actually think it's more doable than people believe. Reflect for a minute on the Democratic primaries in connection with the presidential campaign. Bernie Sanders did far better than people expected. In large part, that was due to communities like the Williams College community, young and old people who came together to champion a variety of causes, including addressing climate change. And lo and behold, Secretary Clinton's positions on climate and the Democratic Party's positions have improved. And I think those folks who chose to engage rather than be on the sidelines deserve a lot of credit. We need more of that. That's my first and biggest ask.